This is Lecture 7 in the series Essentials of Capitalism. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I want to continue with our analysis of the influence of the division of labor on the institutions of capitalism, this time with respect to economic competition. In a division of labor society, competition is of a radically different character than it is in the animal kingdom. In the animal kingdom, competition is over a limited, nature-given supply of means of subsistence. For the lions in the jungle, for example, there are only so many zebras or gazelles in the surrounding territory. Once the population of lions grows to stand in a sufficiently high ratio to that of the surrounding species that it eats, the individual lions are placed in competition with one another for survival. For each lion that succeeds in obtaining a supply of food, the survival of some other lion is jeopardized, for there is simply not enough to go around. In these conditions, those lions who have the keenest senses of vision and smell, who can run fastest and furthest, and who are the strongest, survive, while those who are less well endowed in these respects perish. This is truly the law of the jungle and the survival of the fittest. The competition that exists in a division of labor capitalist society, on the other hand, is so radically different that it is actually of a diametrically opposite character. It is not a competition over any limited, nature-given supply of means of subsistence. On the contrary, it is a competition in the positive creation of new and additional wealth. Ford and General Motors, IBM and Apple, and so on, are not competing in any seizure of a fixed supply of automobiles or computers provided by nature. They are competing in the positive creation of more and better automobiles and computers. Man does not obtain his automobiles, food, computers, or anything else that he requires as a gift from nature. He must produce it. His possession of reason and his organization of production into a system of division of labor enable him to steadily increase the total of the wealth he produces. Unlike the lions in the jungle, man increases the size of the animal herds that serve him, to return to that example. He domesticates them. He studies their requirements for health and nutrition and so on. He grows food for them and studies the requirements for the health and nutrition of the crops that feed them. He progressively expands and implements such knowledge with ever-increasing benefit to himself, and similarly with regard to every other source of his material well-being. Economic competition takes place within this context, the context of unlimited potential improvement in man's material well-being, based on his possession of reason and the organization of production into a system of division of labor. What economic competition is about is not the means of subsistence, but, as I explained in Lecture 2, the selection of products for markets, of technological methods for producing any particular product, and of persons for specific occupations. It is a competition for the patronage of customers and for the services of workers, a competition which can be won only in degree that one renders labor more productive and so operates to raise the general standard of living. Economic competition is the process of achieving an ever more efficient organization of the division of labor. It is not in contrast to social cooperation, as so many people have believed. It is precisely the process of steadily reorganizing the system of social cooperation, the division of labor, so as steadily to raise the productivity of labor and increase the quantity and quality of products produced and pouring onto the market. In this competition, there are no genuine long-run losers, only winners. Everyone benefits from the ever-increasing wealth that economic competition creates. Even those who at first sight appear to be losers turn out to be winners, and usually fairly quickly. Consider, for example, the effect of the competition of the automobile on blacksmiths, horse breeders, and buggy makers. These losers in this competition suffered only a very temporary loss in the period in which it was necessary for them to adapt their skills to the requirements of other jobs. Once they did this, the only permanent effect on them of the competition they lost, in quotes, was that along with everyone else, they too obtained the benefit of the automobile in their capacity as consumers. including, of course, the benefit of having all manner of products transported by means of trucks rather than horse-drawn wagons. In exactly the same way, the farmers using horses and mules, who lost out in competition to other farmers using tractors and harvesters, ended up in different jobs. Only now, along with everyone else, they were able to obtain their food cheaper and had money left over for the purchase of larger quantities of other things. Other things that could now be produced because the labor required for their production was no longer tied up in growing food inefficiently. Please observe that there is room for all in the competition of a division of labor society. To lose, in quotes, in such competition does not mean to be cast out of the productive system and to perish. It means only to have to relocate to some other point in the productive system, to produce some different product, to work in some different occupation, or perhaps to continue in the same occupation, and only to have to learn to produce one's present product differently. And the effect of making such adjustments is almost always that one ends up benefiting, even from the very improvement in production that caused one's initial loss, in quotes. In the same way as occurred in the examples I just gave of the blacksmiths et al. And of the backward farmers. The so-called weak in particular gain from the process of economic competition. Consider all those millions who would have perished from hunger or malnutrition, or from disease or accident, who suffer from some impairment of vision or hearing, who lack the muscles or the agility to live in the jungle or the forest. And now consider the effect on them of competition among farmers and farm equipment manufacturers, among pharmaceutical makers and manufacturers of diagnostic equipment, among the makers of eyeglasses and hearing aids, among the producers of every labor-saving device and life-enhancing product. Economic competition is not a process by which the success of the biologically fit brings about the extermination of the biologically weak. On the contrary, it is the process by which the success of better products and more efficient methods of production promotes the survival and well-being of all. It is a process in which the success of the more able raises the productivity and improves the standard of living of the less able. For their competitive success is merely their achievement of positions in which they, rather than the less able, take charge of production. The less able remain in the productive system and are more productive because they work under the direction of the more able. Economic competition is, as I say, the process of improving the efficiency of social cooperation under the division of labor, and thus of promoting the survival of every member of the human species. I now want to consider in more detail the matter of the short-run temporary losses that various people can experience in connection with economic competition. And then I want to explain more fully why there is room in the competition of a division of labor society, even for people who are less efficient than others, in every respect. I will show precisely why and how even such people can have a secure place in a division of labor society. I also want to explain further why, by the very same token, such people not only need not fear the competition of those who are more able than themselves, but derive incalculable benefits from their existence. Where appropriate, I will apply the principles derived from our discussion to the questions of international competition and free trade. One of my major themes throughout will be that the hardships usually blamed on competition are not the result of competition, but of government intervention infringing the freedom of competition. In order to understand the problem of short-run losses, and why in a free economy it would not be a very great one, let us consider the inherent difficulties of adjusting to the effects of competition that are experienced by three different groups of people: unskilled workers, skilled workers, and businessmen with invested fortunes. Between them, these groups embrace everyone directly affected. When competition makes obsolete the job of an unskilled worker, there is no intrinsic reason for his short-run loss period to be longer than a few weeks or months, for that is the period of time required to acquire a comparable level of skill in some other unskilled job. From that point on, he should be back where he was in his capacity as an income earner, and he should now be in a position to benefit in his capacity as a consumer, a buyer, from the very improvement in production that displaced him. This, of course, assumes the existence of some other job for him to take. That is certainly true. But as I explained yesterday, in our discussion of the abundance of opportunities, there are always far more potential jobs out there waiting to be done than we are capable of doing. If the government does not intervene and so prevent the exploitation of employment opportunities that the nature of reality provides in superabundance, then there will indeed be other jobs available. And in modern conditions, in which even the very poorest workers can afford the cost of a bus ride that will take them practically anywhere in the country within days, alternative employment opportunities can be drawn from the entire length and breadth of the land. The intrinsic difficulties in the way of people adjusting to the temporary job losses caused by competition are now less than ever, and diminish with every further improvement in transportation and communications. The temporary losses suffered by skilled workers are necessarily longer lasting than those of unskilled workers. If a skill is made obsolete that required 2 or 3 years to learn, then it will probably take that much time for such a worker to acquire a comparable level of skill in some other line of work, and thus, once again, to earn a comparable level of income. But even so, if the worker does reestablish his level of skill and income, then from that point on, he too benefits from the very improvement that initially cost him his job. For he is now even in his capacity as an income earner and ahead in his capacity as a consumer. For example, a typesetter displaced by automated typesetting equipment would come out a permanent net gainer from the lower cost books, newspapers, and magazines that that improvement made possible, once he acquired a comparable level of skill and income in some other line of work, perhaps 2 or 3 years later. Now, I have been stressing that in a free society, individuals end up gaining even from the improvements that initially make them lose their jobs. It should not be forgotten, of course, that they also benefit from the overwhelmingly greater number of improvements that do not make them temporarily lose their jobs, but which purely and simply benefit them in their capacity as consumers. For example, the typesetter I just referred to benefits purely and simply from the effects of competition on the production of food, housing, clothing, transportation, and everything else to which he is related merely as a consumer. For every individual, such improvements are always in the great majority, for the simple reason that he works in only one industry at any one time, while competition affects all industries. His job is potentially threatened only by the competition which goes on within his industry, or between his industry and one or more other industries. It is not threatened by any of the competition that goes on in all the rest of the economic system, by all the competition that goes on within and between all the other industries and that does not directly relate to his one industry. Such competition merely improves his position as a consumer. Thus, the position of the individual in a capitalist society is that over the course of his lifetime, competition improves the production and lowers the cost of practically everything, and introduces many totally new and previously unheard of products, with the result that the standard of living of the average person steadily rises. But from time to time, the nature of the competition is such that the individual must change his job. At that point, his standard of living temporarily declines. The fall in his standard of living is from an upward sloping line, so to speak. And if he acquires a comparable level of skill in another type of work, his standard of living is soon raised to a point further up the line than it ever was before, in part precisely because of the improvement that displaced it. The picture that emerges of an individual's life under capitalism in connection with competition is one of steady improvement punctuated by a few brief periods of setback, of temporary declines from a rising line. The impact of such periods of setback could, of course, be minimized by the possession of savings. It could also be greatly reduced in most cases by forethought in the form of paying attention to the factors affecting the existence of one's job and making preparations for obtaining a new job before the loss of one's present job. In the case of skilled workers, this would mean learning a new skill while one still had one's old job. In a free economy, the only case of a loss period that is necessarily long and major is that of wealthy individuals who lose an invested fortune as the result of competition. The owner of a harness factory or horse breeding farm in the early years of this century, who lost perhaps $1 million when his investment became obsolete, was far less likely to be able to accumulate $1 million a second time than his workers to adapt their skills to the requirements of other jobs. It is incomparably more difficult to earn $1 million than to learn a new job, even a highly skilled one. Of course, even this is not impossible, and there are numerous instances of individuals who have made and lost several fortunes. But for many people, especially those whose wealth has come to them through inheritance rather than their own abilities, it is simply out of the question to earn back a fortune. Let us focus now on the effects of competition on this group, the only group that must probably suffer a major and prolonged loss as the result of free competition. Can its members legitimately claim to be harmed by competition? Let us realize, first of all, that the effect of competition on this group is certainly not to cause the extermination of its members, but merely their reduction from a relatively high position in the economic system to the ranks of the average, more or less. And let us keep in mind that the position of the average member of the society is steadily rising because of competition. Thus, it is only a question of time before the standard of living of a former millionaire would rise to the point where it was higher in his position as an average worker than it used to be when he was a millionaire. This is not merely a theoretical projection. It describes the actual historical facts of capitalism. The average worker in the United States today is materially far better off than a millionaire of a century ago, than even the world's very richest people of that time, or of any other time much before the beginning of the present century. He has at his disposal all kinds of goods they simply did not have, such as automobiles, airplanes, electric light, radios, telephones, television sets, phonographs, motion pictures, tape recorders, air conditioners, refrigerators, freezers, antibiotics, modern anesthetics, and all the other advances of modern medicine. No one in the world had any of these things much before the beginning of the present century. Not Queen Victoria, not Napoleon, not Louis XIV, not any of the Roman emperors or Egyptian pharaohs. Of course, most people who lose a fortune cannot live long enough for further competition and progress to give them a higher standard of living as an average person than they previously had as a millionaire. If they lose their fortune when they are 65 or even 45 years old, it is virtually impossible that they will live long enough for economic progress to restore the equivalent of all that they have lost. Even if they lost their fortune, say, at age 21, and did perhaps live long enough, finally, say some 60 years later, to have a standard of living as an average person higher than they had had as a millionaire in their youth, the period of gain would be too short compared to the period of loss for us to be able to say that competition had, on the whole, raised their standard of living in their lifetimes. Thus, even though competition and economic progress operate to raise the standard of living of the average person above that of millionaires of previous generations, they do not do so rapidly enough to enable those who lose fortunes to improve their standard of living in their lifetimes. Under pure capitalism, the rate of economic progress would undoubtedly be far higher than it has been up to now, which would certainly mitigate the problem. Perhaps if the entire economic system could achieve a sustained rate of progress comparable to what has existed in the computer industry, the problem would substantially disappear. But for us to deal with the problem, it is not necessary to assume this. Let us take for granted that even under pure capitalism, the loss of those who lost fortunes could in many cases simply not be made good during their lifetimes. But even so, there is no legitimate argument that can be raised against economic competition. Those who lose a fortune cannot logically regard competition as their enemy, for we must consider the foundation on which their fortune rested. If it was acquired legitimately, it could only have been so by virtue of their or their parents' or grandparents' previous success in the process of competition. To have $1 million or more almost certainly requires that someone have earned an exceptional rate of profit that he kept plowing back over a period of years. That exceptional rate of profit represented successful competition. Thus, the fortunes that are lost because of competition were first acquired because of competition. One cannot reasonably denounce the process of competition for taking away what one could not have had without it in the first place. This point applies in a double way. Not only is competition responsible for the existence of any fortune with which one begins, but it is also responsible for the purchasing power of that fortune. Virtually all of the products that can be bought are the result of the process of competition. The millionaire who loses the ability to buy a Rolls-Royce and caviar and champagne, and who ends up having to settle for a Chevrolet and hamburgers, could not have had any of these things without the process of competition. To denounce competition as the source of his loss ignores the foundation of virtually everything he has or ever could have. The same point, of course, applies to everyone else as well, for example, to a worker who might be tempted to denounce competition for a decline in his income. The purchasing power of any income he ever earned or will earn is created by the competition of producers. There would be almost nothing for him to buy without it, and the previously higher money income he earned was itself the result of his own previously more successful competition. It should be realized that it is those who denounce economic competition who are the true advocates of the law of the jungle. They want to preserve their accustomed standard of living by means of prohibiting or restricting the competition of others. The only way they can accomplish such a goal is by means of the initiation of physical force, for competitors will not stay back or stop voluntarily. For example, if the owner of a harness factory wanted to preserve his standard of living by stopping the competition of the automobile, it would not be sufficient for him merely to send a polite letter to Henry Ford explaining the hardship he was suffering on account of Ford's activities, and requesting, therefore, that Ford stop or restrict his business. Ford would obviously disregard such a request, since it is overwhelmingly in his self-interest to go on with his business and increase it. If our harness factory owner were seriously out to stop Ford's activities, the only way he could do so would be by means of force. Either he would have to employ private criminals to stop Ford, by such means as wrecking his facilities and threatening his workers, or he would have to have a law passed, which would stop him with a threat of seizing his property or putting him in prison. One way or another, force would have to be his only recourse, because there is no way that Ford or any other competitor would voluntarily give up the means of making his own fortune in order to preserve the fortune of someone else. Such activity on the part of the harness factory owner, who is in the position usually regarded as that of victim of the law of the jungle, is the real law of the jungle in its human setting, for it is the attempt to live by means of force rather than production and exchange. All those who denounce economic competition implicitly support such behavior, and in this sense are advocates of the law of the jungle. Economic competition itself is now clearly established as the opposite of the law of the jungle. It is a uniquely human mode of survival, the achievement of success by offering progressively better goods and services to others, who have alternatives for spending their money and who must be voluntarily induced to spend it in any particular way, who are induced because they are offered something better. Economic competition is both the product and the agent of man's ongoing use of his mind to improve his life, the product of those who have something newer and better to offer, the agent compelling all others to follow if they are to retain the voluntary patronage of their customers. It is the law not of the jungle, but of progressing civilization, the basis not of the survival of the biologically fittest, but of everyone at a higher and higher level. Our discussion has important implications for the relationship between economic competition and economic security, which need to be developed. Usually, of course, competition is perceived as one of the foremost threats to the individual's economic security, because it can cost him his job. We are now in a position to see that in actuality, the freedom of competition is an essential basis of economic security, that it is so in terms both of the individual's ability to obtain physical goods and services in exchange for the money income he earns, and to earn money income in the first place. Let us realize that in its most fundamental physical sense, economic security means the ability to obtain the goods and services on which one's life and well-being depend. It means that when one is hungry, one can obtain food, that when it is cold or raining, one has a warm, dry house to stay in, and so on. In its fundamental, physical sense, economic security obviously depends on the ability to produce. The ability to produce and physically have goods depends on the freedom of competition. The freedom of competition is thus a fundamental basis of physical economic security. This point can be highlighted by a brief consideration of the medieval guild system, whose absurdity it makes manifest. The guilds existed to give their members economic security. The means chosen by the guilds for achieving economic security was the prohibition of all economic competition, both by outsiders and among their own members. Thus, the Baker's Guild sought security by prohibiting improvements in the production of bread, the Cobbler's Guild by prohibiting improvements in the production of shoes, the Tailor's Guild by prohibiting improvements in the production of clothing, and so on, industry by industry, occupation by occupation. The effect of all this misguided seeking of security was that everyone remained much poorer and therefore much less physically secure than he needed to be. People were deprived of bread and made insecure against hunger because of the activities of the Baker's Guild. They were deprived of shoes and clothing and made insecure against the elements because of the activities of the Cobbler's and Tailor's Guilds, and so on. And those so deprived included the members of all the guilds. Each guild operated to perpetuate the poverty and insecurity of the whole society, that of the population standing outside the guild system, that of the members of all other guilds, and even that of its own members. For recall the discussion of how people benefit even from the improvements that initially displace them. Thus, the guilds operated in a veritable self-contradiction. They professed a desire for security, and yet, in fact, perpetuated insecurity. Much the same is true of our modern-day labor unions. The focus of the guilds, of course, was not on the physical basis of economic security in the production and availability of goods, but on the ability of their members to have jobs and earn money income. In this respect, too, their policy operated paradoxically, in that they themselves created the very insecurity with respect to income and employment that they feared and complained of. Again, the same point applies to our modern-day labor unions and the other measures of government interference in the labor market. Consider the following situation, which will prove this point. Someone loses his job because competition makes it obsolete. He must now find a new job. What does this mean? It means he must turn around and enter the labor market of some other industry or occupation as a new competitor. What does he require as a new competitor? He requires the freedom of competition. If the whole economic system has the freedom of competition, the hardships accompanying our man's losing his original job need not be very great at all. He is free to compete anywhere else in the entire economic system and will obviously pick whichever industry or occupation he feels is most advantageous for him, given his abilities, including his willingness to learn. The freedom of competition, recall, also ensures the availability of an abundance of jobs. It does so because, as I explain in Capitalism, the Cure for Racism, it makes wages, costs of production, and prices low enough so that whatever the amount of spending of money that exists in the economic system, it will be sufficient to employ everyone seeking work and to buy all that they produce. Interjection. Be sure to see Chapter 13 of Capitalism on this subject. Thus, under the full freedom of competition, the problems of finding alternative employment are minimal. But now consider what must happen as restrictions on the freedom of competition are introduced. Now, alternative employment opportunities begin to be closed off. The consequence of losing one's present job thus becomes more severe. At the same time, with every further restriction of the freedom of competition, pressures are created calling for still more restrictions. Because with every reduction in the alternative opportunities for employment, more and more workers must crowd into the industries and occupations still open to them. In these industries and occupations, their products and services are in artificial oversupply. and their wages must suffer correspondingly. In addition, their productivity declines because an artificial scarcity exists of the complementary means of production that must be obtained from the restricted industries and occupations, quite possibly at prices that have risen as a direct result of the expansion of the remaining free areas. As conditions grow worse in the remaining free areas, more and more of them are led to demand restrictions of their own, as a matter of self-defense. And then there is simply no place for an unemployed worker to go. By then, almost everyone lives in terror of losing his job and opposes everything that might have that effect. It is clear that it is mainly the existence of the restrictions on competition that makes them seem so necessary. They are the cause of the terrifying insecurity that grips so many people at the prospect of losing their job and makes them so desperately fear competition. Competition is terrifying when one is not allowed to compete. People are terrified of losing the competition concerning their present jobs because if they lose it, they are prohibited from competing for alternative employment. The prohibitions on their competing elsewhere are what make them cling so tenaciously to the jobs they have. The belief that the freedom to compete is a threat to our security is completely wrong. The freedom to compete is a precondition of our security. The belief that it is a threat is an illusion based largely on the lack of the freedom to compete. It, this belief, is a real source of insecurity, for it leads to the restriction of competition. As a further illustration of these principles, I want to return briefly to our discussion of the short-run loss periods connected with competition. Hostility to competition leads to the imposition of seniority rather than merit as the criterion for promotion and pay increases. This artificially lengthens the short-run loss periods associated with competition. A level of skill and income that in fact should take only a few weeks or months, or perhaps in the case of skilled workers, 2 or 3 years to achieve, may be stretched out to 10 or 20 years by the seniority system. As a result, a worker who may lose a relatively modest investment in terms of genuinely necessary experience, which he could reacquire with relatively little difficulty in another job, is made to lose a vast investment in seniority, which he can reacquire only with tremendous difficulty. The growth of the seniority system is the result of the influence of labor unions and the civil service mentality, which influence in turn rests on government intervention, and thus on the violation of the freedom of competition. Now let us consider just why there is not only room, but actual need for everyone in the competition of a division of labor society, even for those who are less capable than others in every respect. One reason is the fact we have mentioned several times. Our need and desire for goods and services are virtually unlimited, while our ability to produce goods and services is always strictly limited. Thus, we have a need for all the productive ability we can find, even for productive ability on the most modest scale. A good example of this is the case of a one-man business, which begins to grow. Originally, its owner had time to do everything, from making all the most important decisions to sweeping the floor. But now, as his business begins to grow, it is physically impossible for him to do all these things. It pays him to begin to employ others to do jobs which he might be better able to do than they, but which he simply lacks the time to do. Thus, even though he might potentially make a better secretary than the secretary he employs, and be better at sweeping floors than the janitor he has hired, it pays him to employ these people in order to be able to carry on a larger scale of activity. Their presence enables him to concentrate on the performance of tasks in which his superiority is greater and more important, such as thinking about what needs to be done in his business. And this brings us to the law of comparative advantage, or, as von Mises calls it, the law of association. This law holds that human cooperation in a division of labor is mutually advantageous even when one party is productively superior to the other in every way, because it allows the superior party to concentrate on those areas of his superiority which are greater and more important, that is, on his areas of comparative advantage. By the same token, the inferior party concentrates on those areas in which his inferiority is less or less important, which represents his comparative advantage. Although originally advanced by David Ricardo to show that international free trade and division of labor were mutually advantageous even when one country could produce every single good without exception with less labor than its trading partners, the best and clearest illustration of the principle, I think, is the case of Edison and his cleaning lady. The existence of the cleaning lady enables Edison to devote more time to inventing, an area in which his productive superiority relative to the cleaning lady is incalculably greater and more important than it is in cleaning, however great it might be there. Such examples abound, not only the boss and his secretary, but the physician and his x-ray technician, the architect and his draftsman, the engineer and the mechanic, and so on. These are all cases in which one party could almost certainly do the work of the other more efficiently than the other does it, but in which it does not pay him to do it, because it would mean time away from his own work, in which his superiority is greater and more important. In the case of international trade, a good example of the principle of comparative advantage would be the following. Assume that with modern technology and mechanized picking, the United States can grow coffee in hothouses with less total labor, including the labor of building and maintaining the hothouses, than it can be grown with in the open air in Brazil, where it must be picked by hand. Specifically, imagine that the labor required to produce X bags of coffee in the United States is 1 million man days, while in Brazil it is 2 million man days. Assume further, however, that in the United States it is possible to produce Y automobiles with 500,000 man days of labor, and that the same quantity of automobiles requires 5 million man days of labor to be produced in Brazil. Will the United States grow its own coffee and undersell Brazil even in coffee, merely because it can produce it with less labor than Brazil? The answer is no. It will pay the United States and Brazil each to concentrate on their comparative advantage and to trade. The United States will not devote 1 million man days to producing its own coffee. Instead, it will devote an additional 500,000 man days to producing automobiles, its area of comparative advantage, and exchange them for the quantity of coffee it would have cost 1 million man days to produce at home. The effect will be that the United States gets its coffee and saves the labor of 500,000 man days, with which it produces additional products to be enjoyed in addition to the coffee. The Brazilians will gladly give that amount of coffee for that amount of automobiles, because in doing so they obtain for 2 million man days of labor devoted to coffee growing a quantity of automobiles that would have cost them 5 million man days of labor to produce. Thus, division of labor and trade are still mutually advantageous. The absolute advantage of the United States in growing coffee is irrelevant, because it gains much more by concentrating on automobile production, in which its absolute advantage is far greater. It should be realized, incidentally, that in degree that the United States does concentrate on cars and Brazil on coffee, the total combined production that both countries obtain from the same amount of labor increases. If there is no concentration, and each country simply produces its own coffee and automobiles, then the United States produces X of coffee with a labor of 1 million man days, and Y of cars with a labor of 500,000 man days. Brazil produces a further X of coffee with a labor of 2 million man days, and a further Y of cars with a labor of 5 million man days. The combined output of the two countries, obtained from the labor of 1.5 million man days in the United States and 7 million man days in Brazil, is 2x of coffee plus 2y of cars. But now, if the United States gives up coffee growing and switches the labor previously employed in producing coffee into producing cars, it can produce 3y of cars. If Brazil gives up automobile production and switches the labor previously employed in producing cars to producing coffee, it can now produce 3.5x of coffee. The total combined production of the two countries obtained from the same total labor thus increases from 2x plus 2y to 3.5x plus 3y, just by virtue of employing the labor along the lines of comparative advantage. Production increases because the United States eliminates the production of a good in which its superiority is 2 to 1, in order to expand its production of a good in which its superiority is 10 to 1. At the same time, Brazil gives up the production of a good in which its inferiority is 1 to 10 in order to expand the production of a good in which its inferiority is 1 to 2. The principle is that both countries gain in degree that they curtail their production of goods in which their superiority is less or their inferiority greater, in order to expand their production of goods in which their superiority is greater or their inferiority less. The introduction of money into our example will help to reinforce our conclusion that it is economically worthwhile for each country to concentrate on its areas of comparative advantage, and will make possible wider application of the principle. Assume simply that wages in the United States are more than double what they are in Brazil, say triple. In this case, even though it takes half the labor to grow coffee in the U.S. as in Brazil, it will be 1.5 times more expensive to do so, because of our higher wages. So on a dollars and cents basis, we would be led not to grow coffee. We would concentrate on producing automobiles, where our cost would not be 1/10 of Brazil's, but 3/10, after allowing for our 3 times higher level of wages. Now, how do we know that our wages will be more than twice as high as Brazil's, and thus that it will pay us to leave coffee growing to Brazil? We can find the answer if we assume initially that our wages are no higher than Brazil's, and then see what happens. What we are assuming now is the nightmare case of the Brazilian protectionists. For in this case, it is cheaper to produce everything in the United States, and the United States could undersell Brazil even in coffee. What will happen under these conditions? The answer, which the protectionists claim to know all too well, is that the United States won't buy anything from Brazil, while Brazil will try to buy everything from the United States. And that is exactly right. But what is the consequence of this? The consequence is that money leaves Brazil and enters the United States. In Brazil, the effect will be less spending, less demand for labor and goods. In the United States, there will be somewhat more demand for labor and goods. I say somewhat more because, being a much larger economy, the transfer of any given sum of spending power will represent a much smaller percentage increase here than it does decrease there. In any case, if the freedom of competition exists in Brazil, wages and prices in Brazil will come down as a result, while in the United States they will rise somewhat. They will continue falling in Brazil and rising in the United States until the change in relative wages, costs, and prices between the two countries makes Brazil the cheaper country for the United States and other countries to buy from, as often as the United States and other countries are cheaper for Brazil to buy from. Only then will money stop flowing out of Brazil and her wages, costs, and prices stop falling. Since our productivity of labor advantage in coffee is relatively modest, our cost advantage there will be among the first to disappear as Brazilian wage rates fall and ours rise. We can infer from this discussion that there is room for every country in the world market. However backward it may be in its methods of production, it can still be competitive in whatever it sells, provided only that its relative money wage rates compensate for its deficiencies in the productivity of labor. Imagine, for example, that the labor of one country was uniformly half as productive as that of another, that is, required twice the time to produce every good. Such a country would nevertheless have the same costs of production and be able to sell profitably at the same prices as the more advanced country, provided only that its wage rates were half as great. For half the wages per hour times double the number of hours equals the same costs of production. Likewise, if its productivity of labor were a third, a fifth, or a tenth as great, it would have the same costs of production and be able to sell profitably at the same prices as any more advanced country, provided only that its wages were a third, a fifth, or a tenth as great as those of its more advanced competitor. The principle that emerges is that every country can be internationally competitive provided its relative level of money wages corresponds to its relative productivity of labor. The mutual gains that accompany every country's presence in the world market stem from the fact that the differences in the productivity of labor are not uniform. There is comparative advantage. A country with half the wage level almost certainly does not have half the productivity of labor in the production of each and every good, but just as a kind of weighted average. In the production of many goods, it has less than half the productivity of labor. In the production of many others, it has more than half the productivity of labor. In the cases in which it has less than half the productivity of labor, that is, requires more than twice the labor to produce a good, its wage level prices it out of the market and it imports. But in every case where it has more than half the productivity, that is, requires less than twice the labor to produce a good, its wage level puts its costs below those of its competitors and it exports. In this way, each country tends to curtail the production of some things and expand the production of others, and thus to participate in the international division of labor in accordance with the principle of comparative advantage. The very fact of each country's expansion of its areas of comparative advantage then makes possible still further economies associated with division of labor and production on a larger scale. In connection with the kinds of examples I have been using, I want to call your attention to what I can only describe as the split vision of the protectionists. In the backward countries, the protectionists claim that free trade will be ruinous because of the higher productivity of the more advanced countries. In the more advanced countries, they claim that free trade will be ruinous because of the low wages of the backward countries, that to have free trade with the low-wage countries is to, quote, import their standard of living, unquote. The truth is, of course, that the higher productivity of labor of the more advanced countries is counterbalanced by their higher wages, and the lower wages of the backward countries are counterbalanced by their lower productivity of labor. Where there is no counterbalancing between differences in wages and the productivity of labor, and at the same time there are equal competitive advantages and disadvantages on both sides, we have the gains from comparative advantage. The source of problems in international trade is the persistence of wage rates that are too high in relation to a country's productivity of labor. If a country has two or five times the average productivity of labor as its trading partners, then it can be competitive with wages two or five times as high as theirs, but not with wages, say, 2.5 or 6 times as high as theirs. By the same token, the countries with the low productivities of labor can be competitive with wages of 1/2 or 1/5, but not 2/3 or 1/4 those of their trading partners. In a labor market subject to the freedom of competition, such undue differences could not persist. The unemployment resulting from them would drive down wages and costs and restore the country's international competitiveness and the full employment of its labor force as well. But where labor unions, minimum wage laws, and other government interference prevents wage rates from falling, or from falling enough, the problem of unemployment remains and tends to grow worse. For more and more companies that have kept their prices competitive and paid the higher wages at the expense first of funds for capital improvements, and then at the expense of dividends and funds for capital replacement, cut back or go out of business altogether. This is exactly what has occurred in the American automobile industry, steel industry, and many other branches of American industry. Government intervention in the form of labor legislation, confiscatory taxation, inflation, and deficit spending first deprived American businesses of the capital funds required for raising the productivity of labor. Union work rules and government regulations also operated to prevent the rise in the productivity of labor, or to actually reduce it. Meanwhile, foreign competitors in countries with tax systems and monetary policies far less hostile to capital accumulation and without such labor union and regulatory interference have rapidly improved their productivity of labor. This combination of circumstances is what has made vast branches of American industry unable to compete at today's relative wage levels. All this, of course, is usually ignored. The most popular explanation for the whole problem is the triviality of the alleged bad judgment of the automobile companies in continuing to produce large cars after Ralph Nader had decided he wanted small cars. That, plus reference to cycles of inevitable decline. The actual solution to our lack of competitiveness, and to most of our other economic problems, would be to abolish the coercive powers of the unions, abolish the welfare state and its massive spending, so that deficits could be eliminated and taxes on capital formation radically reduced or abolished, and to restore the gold standard and stop inflation. But this almost certainly will not be done. What most likely will be done is that foreign competition will be severely restricted. The effect of that will be more than that we will lose many of the benefits of international division of labor. It will contribute to future wars. Countries like Japan, with huge populations and small territories, vitally depend on being able to export manufactured goods in order to be able to import food and raw materials. If we close them out of major export markets, we threaten their vital interests. We give them grounds to hate us and an economic rationale for war as a means either of forcing open markets or of seizing the food and mineral-producing territories they are prevented from earning the foreign exchange to buy from and making them into captive markets. Of course, for now and the foreseeable future, the Japanese are not capable of being a military threat to us. Interestingly, however, as if to remedy this, the same United States Congress, which has tried to restrict their exports to this country, has also urged them, in the very same session, to increase their military expenditures. It is not impossible that a strongly protectionist policy on our part would someday push them into an alliance with the Russians. An important implication of this whole discussion is that one of the requirements of free trade, and thus of world peace, is free labor markets. That is what is necessary to keep a country's wage level in a proper relationship to the wage levels of its competitors, and so enable it to have free trade without fear of mass unemployment developing because it is too widely undersold. A further implication is that since labor legislation in the long run is incompatible with free trade, it is a threat to friendly international relations and thus to world peace. This is a further, very important reason for abolishing it. Let us return now to the application of the law of comparative advantage to competition within a country's own labor market. The principle that wage differences compensate for productivity differences shows how less efficient individuals can be fully competitive with more efficient individuals in seeking employment. All they have to do is offer to accept wage rates that are lower in degree that their productivity is lower. For example, a man who can lay only X bricks per hour can be fully competitive with workers who can lay 2X bricks per hour, provided only that he is willing to accept half the hourly pay they receive. Indeed, less efficient individuals can, and often do, outcompete more efficient individuals for jobs simply by virtue of their wages being lower in greater degree than their productivity is lower. The worker who can lay 20 bricks per hour and asks a dollar an hour outcompetes the worker who can lay 40 bricks an hour but asks $3 an hour. The first man's cost per brick laid to an employer is only 5 cents, that of the second man 7.5 cents. The law of comparative advantage guarantees a job for everyone, a job in which he outcompetes all other contenders for that job, no matter how modest his abilities, provided only that the labor market is free to bring about the appropriate adjustments in relative wage rates. As the wage rates of less capable people fall relative to those who are more capable, they are able to match or exceed in more and more employments what a more capable person is able to offer an employer per dollar of cost. When the wages of a less capable person are half those of a more capable person, he is the more economical employee in every job in which his productivity is more than half as great as that of the more capable person. When his wages are only a third of the wages of a more capable person, he is the more economical employee in every job in which his productivity is merely more than a third as great as that of the more capable person, and so on. By the same token, the relatively higher wage rates of those who are more capable operate to reserve their talents and abilities for those specific employments in which their relative productivity is great enough to offset their higher wage rates. A man with a 3 times higher wage rate, for example, is the more economical employee in any occupation in which his relative productivity is more than 3 times as great as that of the less capable person. He is the more economical employee in any occupation that the less capable person is simply incapable of performing at all or of performing adequately. As I indicated in Lecture 2, the higher wage rates of more capable people, derivable from those employments whose requirements they alone can satisfy, or in which their relative productivity is otherwise sufficiently high, operate to keep such people out of the portions of the labor market served by the less capable people. For example, an engineer or doctor capable of laying 100 or even 200 bricks an hour would not dream of working as a bricklayer, nor could anyone dream of employing him as one, given his ability to earn, say, $50 or $100 an hour as an engineer or doctor. His relative productivity advantage as a bricklayer may be 5 or 10 to 1, but his advantage as a doctor or engineer gives him an income so high that he would need to have an unattainable relative productivity advantage of 50 or 100 to 1 before such an occupation as bricklaying could make economic sense for him. It is no exaggeration to say that at the appropriate level of relative wage rates, people with abilities no greater than that of a janitor are able to outcompete everyone else in the entire world, even the world's most talented people. They not only are capable of doing so, they actually do so, for such jobs as janitor, by being willing to accept the income of a janitor. On the basis of the law of comparative advantage, we have seen that there is room even for the least talented individuals in the productive system of a division of labor society. Even they have a contribution to make that is of benefit to others who are more talented, namely, by taking over tasks in which their productive inferiority is relatively small, they enable those who are more talented to concentrate on areas where their productive superiority is still greater and more important. Competition for jobs is not the enemy of such people. We have seen that they can compete successfully for jobs appropriate to their abilities, provided they are free to accept the necessary wage rates. Indeed, free competition is precisely what they need to be successful in getting the jobs they want. The enemy of such people is the misguided attempt to give them wages they are unable to earn. That attempt, principally in the form of minimum wage laws and pro-union legislation, is tantamount to prohibiting such people from competing. It prohibits them from competing by the one means that can compensate for their low productivity, namely, sufficiently low wage rates. In the name of a misguided humanitarianism, people are stopped from competing and the results are blamed on competition. The poor and weak, we are told, have no jobs and no income because they have been overrun by the competition of the strong that casts them adrift and leaves them to perish. Well, all of that is the sheerest nonsense. They haven't been overrun by the competition of those who are more able, but by the police who were sent in by the humanitarians to stop them from competing where they could successfully have competed. The humanitarians, the so-called liberals, are responsible for millions of low-skilled people, most notably black teenagers, being prohibited from competing. In their alleged goodness and kindness, their sympathy, understanding, and compassion, all those tender words they wrap themselves in, they've condemned millions to unemployment and a lifetime of poverty on the welfare rolls. Had these people been free to take a low-paying job, on the other hand, most of them would have gained some skills and experience that would have fitted them for better-paying jobs later on. Many of them would have seen the need for further education and have gone and gotten it. Our discussion of the law of comparative advantage explained the nature of the productive contribution of the less able to the more able. Now let us consider the incalculably greater productive contribution of the more able to the less able. In effect, having considered the contribution of the cleaning lady to Edison, let us now consider the contribution of Edison to the cleaning lady. We can call the principle we are now about to consider the Pyramid of Ability principle, which is the name given to it by Ayn Rand. My own formulation of the principle is this. In degree that those who are more able occupy the higher positions in a division of labor society, the productivity of those in the lower positions is increased. We can consider several examples. If a better qualified person becomes foreman in a factory, the workers under him will produce more than if a poorer qualified person became foreman. If a better qualified person becomes company vice president or president, all those working under him will produce more than if a poorer qualified person got the position. If two people both want to be an automotive engineer, and the better qualified succeeds while the less qualified ends up as an auto mechanic, the better qualified one can raise the productivity of the poorer qualified one by designing a better car for him to work on. If their positions were reversed, this would not be possible. More broadly and fundamentally, if there is the freedom to invent new and better products and new and better methods of production, and to start and expand new lines of business that produce or implement them, the productivity of all who help to produce these things or who use them in production or who are simply unable to buy them by virtue of the work they presently do, is raised. It is raised by the activities of the inventors, businessmen, and investors who made those improvements possible. The division of labor itself, as it exists within every factory and workplace, is a marvelous example of how the activities of those who are more capable raise the productivity of those who are less capable. As I explained in Lecture 1, their work of breaking the production of a product into a series of very small, very simple, repetitious steps, which they then concentrate and coordinate, allows people of very little ability to produce highly complex products, such as automobiles and television sets. The contribution of the more able to the productivity of the less able can be gauged by the fact that even janitors, merely by the effort of pushing a broom, can actually obtain automobiles, television sets, and almost all the other products of modern technology, products which on their own they could never possess. It follows from this discussion that in losing the competition for the higher positions in a division of labor society, those who are less qualified do not in fact lose, but win. Their productivity of labor and standard of living are raised by the greater success of those who are more able than they. Were they to somehow force their way into the higher positions, they would lose, for they would destroy the productivity of labor of all those under them, and thus the possibility of obtaining the goods they wanted. For example, I would like to have the income of the president of General Motors, which is a substantial multiple of my own. If by some means, despite my total lack of knowledge and experience, or even interest in the automobile industry, I could force my way into his job, I would certainly reduce the production of General Motors by an enormously greater amount than corresponds to any additional income I would receive. For I'd be disrupting the work of hundreds of thousands of people and causing the misuse of billions of dollars of capital. Perhaps, if this were the only instance of its kind in the whole economic system, I might still have a substantial gain for myself, provided I didn't have to trust my own life to GM products. The enormous loss I caused would fall almost entirely on others. But now suppose someone else just like me has become president of the airline I fly with, or he's the surgeon who will operate on me, and so on. As my sort of action becomes more widespread, it is impossible for anyone to gain from it. Everyone suffers losses. Those who succeed in getting the positions they don't deserve and can't obtain under the freedom of competition, along with all whom they victimize. In this way, they would actually end up losing by obtaining the gains they don't deserve. We can now integrate the pyramid of ability principle and the law of comparative advantage into one wider principle that subsumes them both. And that is that in a division of labor society, each person gains from the existence of other people who participate with him in the division of labor. If they are productively less capable than he, his gain from them is described by the law of comparative advantage. If they are productively more capable than he, his gain from them is described by the pyramid of ability principle. In either case, looking down the scale or up, the individual gains from the existence of others who participate with him in the division of labor. The great precondition of his gain is the freedom of competition, that everyone should have the legal right to enter every occupation and every industry. That is the condition which simultaneously guarantees him the widest scope for his own talents as a producer and operates to assure that everything he buys will be produced by those best suited to produce it in an environment of constant progress and improvement. The freedom of competition is the true basis of his economic security and the diametric opposite of the law of the jungle. It gives a place in the system of division of labor to everyone, and puts everyone in the particular place for which he is best suited, with the result that the productivity and standard of living of all are increased and go on increasing. So far from being the law of the jungle, the freedom of economic competition emerges as the true principle of the universal brotherhood of man. Thank you.